How do you use address this question of resurrection, of rebirth and renewal, of the ancient story of Easter, or the return of fertility that's symbolized by the sun's warmth? The recognition of the earth's reawakening can be thought of as a resurrection. For those of us who have lived closely on the land, the budding crocuses and the emerging rhubarb remind us that we will have food, and we will have warmth, and longer days soon. We see the earth's fertility return from our cold winter, and we can rejoice and celebrate. I can celebrate with pagans the wheel of life that is so obvious as the earth turns and the seasons cycle. That's an easy visual and sensorial experience, although it may be less and less of one as our climate gets more out of whack. But this Christian idea of resurrection, what do we do with that? So here, Canadian UU shares her minister's comments, and this came from Maryland, who shared it with me this week. So here's what the minister said. I imagine those disciples the day after Jesus died. They fought, they loved, they gave things up, and you can imagine how very definitively they knew in their bones, this is the end of our story. They had no way of knowing, thousands of years later, that people all over the world would think of it as that, think of that part as the beginning. So resurrection can be thought of as taking this moment of being, having failed or being hurt, and saying to yourself, this isn't the end of the story. This might be chapter 3 or 8. There are more fights to come. Comfort comes in the power that we have when we're ready to say, this isn't the end. Let's find out what happens next. Cultures all over the world and throughout historic time have celebrated Mother Earth and the return of fertility at this time of year. But Christianity did give it a different flavor. In any case, from Persephone to Jesus, we all rise from our virtual deaths in one way or another during this season. Now, however, we are facing a different kind of death. We're facing the imminent collapse of our global civilization due to climate catastrophe. And that might be too alarmist for you. But the 2018 report of the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change states it categorically. They write, climate change is the biggest global health threat of the 21st century. Food supplies are at risk. Higher temperatures and droughts can cause toxic accumulation in plants and in livestock, threatening the health of humans and animals. Plant and insect infestations can increase disease vectors and lead to crop losses. Nutritional quality of ocean fish decreases when water temperatures go up. Rising concentrations of CO2 reduces nutrient levels in food crops like rice and wheat and soybeans, the ones everyone all over the globe depends on. Extreme heat events cause more deaths annually in the U.S., where I have statistics, than all other extreme weather events combined. Who's most vulnerable to heat? The poor, the homeless, the elderly, infants and children, those with cardiac and respiratory conditions. Water scarcity already affects more than 40% of the world's population. As temperatures rise, so does water use. Man-made reservoirs and natural lakes are drying up all over the globe. Water demand is increasing while supply decreases. At the current rate of groundwater depletion, 35% of the United States high plains, where we live in the winter, will be unable to support irrigation by 2040. All of those fields are irrigated. Between 1/3 and 2/3 of the Himalayan glaciers are going to melt by 2100, depending, of course, on how quickly we reduce CO2 emissions. I know it's getting depressing, isn't it? Worldwide, air pollution kills 9 million people every year. Allergies are going to be much worse as pollen counts continue to increase due to heat. Pollution exposure during pregnancy has been linked to a rise in premature births all over the planet. And an increase in high blood pressure is coming is being found in children due to pollution. China's air pollution has cut life expectancy by an average of 5.5 years in the north part of the country. And generally speaking, we know that people of color and the poor are exposed to more air pollution and suffer more from asthma and respiratory diseases. Fossil fuel extraction is the biggest cause of increased CO2 emissions. In a recent article in the National Observer here in Canada, scientists have stated that while many provinces are decreasing their overall emissions in line with the Paris Accord, increases in emissions from the tar sands are undoing all the progress being made elsewhere in Canada, and Canada's overall emissions rose by 8 megatons from 2016 to 2017. The latest year we have statistics. So Keith Stewart, who is with Greenpeace Canada, was quoted in that same article in the National Observer as saying, if we are serious about protecting communities from climate-fueled floods, wildfires, and other extreme weather, the last thing Canada should be doing is building new pipelines to expand oil production and exports. Either we act like this truly is a crisis that threatens our health and survival, or we sleepwalk towards disaster, and our politicians are currently choosing the second option. Okay, we all know this. I could go on for hours telling you all the bad climate news. I'm not going to do that. I just spent a weekend recently learning a lot more about climate with the Climate Reality Corps, which is an Al Gore's organization. And he partners with a fellow, with a man called whose name is Bishop William Barber II. He is a leader and a spokesperson for the Poor People's Campaign in North Carolina. He started Moral Mondays, which you may or may not have heard of. It is definitely a U.S. organization at the moment. But so he's partnering with Al to bring a moral perspective to the climate resistance movement. And he said, our policies have not fundamentally valued human life or the ecological systems in which we live and depend on. Instead, it has prioritized private, corporate, and financial interests over our precious natural resources. We have a fundamental right to clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment, and public resources to monitor, penalize, and reverse the polluting impacts of fossil fuel industries. It's a moral imperative. This organization, the Poor People's Campaign, works for 100% clean and renewable energy. It works for a fully funded public water and sanitation infrastructure, works for a ban on fracking and other extractive industries, and on many more specific issues that prioritize the poor, the rural, the native communities that have been harmed by these industries. Their work is changing lives in the United States, and it should be extended across the globe, like Via Campesino, like the Indigenous Environmental Network, like Navdanya in India. There are many groups around the globe who are continuing to educate and empower people on the ground and resist the impacts of unjust and immoral structures in society. George Monbiot wrote last Monday in The Guardian, no one is coming to save us. And he says, take this as a lesson, mass civil disobedience is essential to force a political response. Catastrophe afflicts people right now. It's not 10 years away. Syrians have left their country due to a massive drought and a government unwilling to maintain a functional society. Guatemalans are leaving their homes because they can't grow food due to the drought. Nebraska farmers right now are leaving their communities because their cattle have drowned or frozen. Their homes were inundated with water and their fields have been poisoned by runoff from chemical manufacturing. Indian farmers are still committing suicide. Climate injustice can be seen in Nigeria, where slave labor is still used to extract oil. You can see it in Guatemala again, where extractive industries like gold mining, in particular Canadian gold mining, are killing people who resist. Environmental racism is happening right now in British Columbia, where the pipelines are being laid through indigenous land, and in Bolivia, where indigenous people are being moved from their lands, their traditional lands, so a corporation from outside can build a dam. Climate refugees are here. They're here in Canada. They're at the southern border of the U.S., which I'm sure you've heard about. They're being isolated on Pacific Islands by Australia. They're everywhere. Climate refugees are everywhere. Mombiot, again, I like it. Those who govern the nations and shape public discourse cannot be trusted with the preservation of life on Earth. They cannot be trusted. And the Bible, I love this. This is Isaiah 10, if you want to check it. Woe unto those who legislate evil. So the question is, where do you stand? You stand for the poor, for injustice, for the sick, for the immigrant, for the vulnerable. Where do we stand as Unitarian Universalists? Where is our moral line? Here's where we say we stand. We say we stand for the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We say we stand for justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. We stand for the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. We stand for respect for the interdependent web of all existence, of which we are a part. There are a few good positive notes in the climate fight. Renewables have been steadily gaining in installations and use and in production in the last 20 years. A huge number of, the Orange Man's arbitrary executive orders giving away United States lands to oil exploration and production. We think we're terribly worried about what he's doing executively, but most of that has been curtailed by the courts. You don't get those front headlines. But the courts are limiting his reach. Both corporations and governments around the world are making pledges to stop investments in oil and gas. They're making investments in renewables. More people are meeting the Paris Accords, more countries. There are folks that are on the ground banding together to resist corporate resource extraction all over the place. And a great example of that is the fight around the Pictou Mill right here in Nova Scotia, which you're probably aware of. Fishers and indigenous protesters and community activists have all formed a powerful organization together that is making a big difference in the provincial conversation. Hopefully, it will also make a big difference in the provincial actions and change the support that has been given to that mill in the future. So, maybe there's hope. How can we hope, and what do we do to maintain our hope? Rebecca Solnit talks about how to hope in the darkness. Her analogy is mushrooms, which often will appear suddenly all over your yard or your field or your forest after a warm rain. The mushroom is the blooming fruit of an underground fungus that spreads underneath the earth where you do not see it. It could not raise its stem and seek the sun without the long reach of the mycological plant underground. So the analogy for Solnit speaks to history. We are all standing on historic shoulders that have reached us underground over time. Rosa Parks did not take that bus seat in a vacuum. The Arab Spring came about suddenly and unexpectedly to us, but to them it was rooted in Gandhi and, interestingly, in hip-hop music. The Berlin Wall fell because the people, after decades of resistance, quiet resistance, simply took hammers to it. Okay. According to Erica Chenoweth's historical research, for a peaceful mass movement to succeed in changing society, 3.5% of the population needs to mobilize. 3.5%. We can and we must do it. We have to cast aside despair, we have to embrace hope, and we have to fight for the planet. It will be necessary to practice how to live in a world without endless fuel, and we're not so good at that. We have to find a way forward without endless growth. But it is not only our task. It's the task of every corporation that extracts anything from the earth, from diamonds to water. It is the task of every business that constructs something, from carpeting to office buildings. It is the task of every government who prioritizes profits and business over people and resources. Take shorter showers if you want. But really, fight water disruption all over the planet in every way possible. Fly less if you can, but do everything you can to keep fossil fuels in the ground. That's a bigger question. Stop using plastics, but if that's too hard, stop buying single-use plastics. Take one step at a time. If anything is better than nothing. Plant food. Compost. Dig up your yard. Stop watering lawns. Support alternative energy sources. Fight the destruction of our land for short-term profits through resource extraction. Write letters, write books, protest, testify in parliament, testify at the school board, educate people, stand with the resistors at every turn. This isn't the end. Let's find out what happens next. And Michael and I are going to share a song with you. You probably know it. It's updated lyrics to Stan Rogers' Northwest Passage. We will sing it. We'll sing the chorus for you. We'll sing the verses, and if you'll join us on the choruses as you are comfortable, if you know the tune, we would welcome that.
Chasing one more gun, we have made the Northwest Passage. We've warned the Arctic waters far from where they ought to be. We've got now metaphor.